This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again, and listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
Hey, this is Elminster of Shadowdale, and you're listening to The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 150. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we're going to start things off fresh by talking about starting a new campaign. That's right, with the new Essentials products coming out aimed at bringing new players into the game, I thought it would be an opportune time to talk about the process of starting a new campaign. And to help with that, I brought in a new guest for the show, Brian Ingard. Did I say your name right?
You did, yeah.
I win. All right, and you are from GameCrafters.net, is that correct?
That is correct.
Awesome. Well, it's good to have you on the show, sir. Welcome.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
In terms of other news in this episode, I don't have a whole heck of a lot because I just recorded episode 149 a couple of days ago, so there's not much has happened in the last few days. I do have episode 151 already recorded, which will feature an interview with the author of the Eberron novel trilogy, Legacy of Dakan, as well as a review of those books. Somehow I need to find more hours in the day because in a few days here, I've built up quite a stable of episodes recorded and ready to go, but I need more time to edit and release and do all that kind of stuff. So one of these days I'm going to get back into my schedule and figure out how to get things to work with the school year going on and releasing podcasts. But until then, we do have this advice episode for the month. Before Brian and I talk about how to build a story outline for a new campaign, though, let's talk about our sponsor for the episode, Noble Knight Games. Noble Knight buys all your old books to sell to someone who wants them, and they carry the latest in-game releases as well. My pick for this episode is the Lords of Madness Huge Pack. Wizards of the Coast has released a new set of D&D minis just recently, and Noble Knight is selling them by the caseload. So for about $130, you get 8 packs of minis. That's 60 randomized minis, some of them huge monsters, and that's $45 off the normal price. You can find that and more great deals at Noble Knight Games.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. Huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com. Or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
All right. Today we're going to do an advice episode about building a campaign. We're going to start off by collaborating to build a story for the opening of a campaign, and we're going to discuss some advice for players about what they can do to make sure that a campaign is successful. And we've also got some guest segments like we oftentimes do for these things. And it is worth noting on a side note that I just recently released a one-shot article on temporaryhitpoints.com written by Robert J. Schwab that happens to be all about players doing their part to help making campaigns engaging. So I thought it was worth noting that given the relevancy to what we are talking about today. But before we get into all that, it's time to find out who Brian Ingard is and why he thinks he's qualified to give you people advice. So, Brian, who the heck are you?
Well, as you mentioned, I run and write for a blog called the Game Crafters Guild at gamecrafters.net. That is primarily an advice blog about 4th edition, although I do throw in things like reviews and house rules and stuff about other games as well. I have also done some freelance work for some small press publishers, including Lewis Porter Jr. Design and Galileo Games. And I am a DM in my own campaign and have been for quite a while. And I have a lot of firsthand experience at creating a campaign and making one successful. So I guess that's what makes me qualified.
Very good. What is the Game Crafters Guild other than your website? Is it actually a group of people, or is it just are you a guild of one?
Currently, I am a guild of one. Okay. I'm trying to build up some steam. People do comment from time to time, but I'd be happy to have guest posts and stuff like that if anyone wants to write for me.
Very cool. What kind of posts are you looking for?
Really anything. I'm not particularly picky at the moment. Like I said, I focus mainly on advice, but house rules are welcome. Reviews are welcome. I'd really like to have the site become more a dialogue than a monologue.
Very good. Very good. All right. Well, I hope people head over to gamecrafters.net and check that out. I know I enjoyed perusing the site the other day when you tweeted me that you were interested in coming on the show and we started setting this whole thing up.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. And in a moment here, Brian and I are going to talk about building a story for starting a campaign. But first, I want to put in a segment from Mike Shea over at SlyFlourish.com, one of my favorite people on the interwebs, and he's got some advice on adventure building.
Hi, this is Mike Shea from SlyFlourish.com and Twitter.com/SlyFlourish. And today I want to talk a little bit about building a campaign. I have a different way of looking at campaign building than a lot of DMs. I prefer to let a campaign sort of build itself out over time, so I don't want to do too much preparation up front. In particular, I don't do hardly any world building at all. I really don't want to spell out an entire history or an entire, you know, build out a whole region of areas. I just want to kind of basically put enough in front of the players that they have a place to start and watch things continue as they go. I like to start out with a campaign elevator pitch, kind of a general one sentence description of what the campaign is all about. I don't want to have things too rigid in a plot, but I also want to have some general theme that the campaign is going to go through. So an example of that would be like at the heroic tier, an ancient necromancer is threatening the land with an army of undead orcs and goblins. That kind of says, okay, here's the main situation, here's the main thing that's going on, the main thing that the party's going to be looking at. Another example at the Paragon tier would be an ancient evil is awakening from underneath the earth and is planning to destroy the whole planet. So now you have a bigger threat and some mystery there as well as to what that threat is or what that ancient evil is. I kind of like to not define that up front so that it kind of comes out as the game progresses. Epic level campaign might be the Demon Prince Grazad is attempting to take over the Astral Sea. So you have a loose direction that the story is going to go and a lot of room for the way things are going to head. I like to think about where adventures actually come from in this campaign. You know, what are the, you want to have like two or three different sources for possible adventures. In planning a Dark Sun campaign, for example, you might have three different places. The PCs might pick up adventures such as being hunting down artifacts in old ruins or being bounty hunters that are out to hunt people down, or maybe they're just hired mercenaries that are there to protect an area or go kind of raid another area. I like to think about what current locations exist for the party. Is there a headquarters that they work out of? You know, everybody kind of goes towards the inn. You know, the local inn and the local bars where everybody kind of picks up work. But I kind of like to have a different area than just that. So maybe they're part of a guild of some sort. Maybe they have a headquarters. Maybe they're part of a the PCs are actually part of a larger gang, and that gang has a has an area that they hang out in. So what is their headquarters? Where do they buy stuff? Where do they get information? You know, what are maybe four or five locations that you want to spell out in pretty good detail so that they have some places they can go. And then what are the adventure areas around there? Is there an underground, a bunch of underground catacombs beneath the city that they adventure in? Is there an old ruin a few miles out of town that they adventure to? You know, is there a, an old earth moat that's floating nearby your epic level city? And that earth moat is, you know, has a strange aura around it. And there's all kinds of weird catacombs in there that the players might explore. Having those adventure areas, again, you don't have to spell them all out, but just kind of having probably about three major locations where adventures can occur. And lastly, I'd like to promote, and I'm always a big fan of Dave Chalker, Dave the Game's 5x5 method. You can find this out by Googling 5x5 adventure building in Google, and you'll read his article about how to build very open-ended, yet still enough of a story or a few stories to keep your players moving forward. So it's a great way to have kind of a a non-on-the-rails adventure, an adventure that's open for players to explore a bunch of different areas, but still gives them direction on where to go. I think it's probably one of the best adventure methods that I've seen for building out a campaign and building out an adventure. So I hope this is useful. Again, I try to keep a loose grip on building out a campaign. I want to kind of watch a campaign grow over time, but you want to have some seeds out there to kind of get things rolling. If you like this, please visit SlyFlourish.com to get more Dungeons & Dragons tips, or visit me on Twitter at twitter.com/SlyFlourish. Thank you very much.
All right, so now it is our turn. We're going to talk about building sort of an opening campaign story outline. We're not going to actually detail out specific encounters or build monsters for it or any of that kind of stuff. We're just going to build a little bit of how do we go about making that opening story as DMs.
Okay.
And I think it's worth noting a few sort of guidelines that I sort of sketched out to sort of give us some context, because it's impossible to build a story with no context.
Right.
At least it is for me.
Right.
So first of all, I think it's worth noting that there are many ways to build a campaign. You can do it, just picking up published adventures, and then all you have to do is come up with that opening hook to get them interested and involved in the story. You can do some collaborative or sandbox style building where, there's more than one DM, or the players take a role in helping to build the story. Lots of different ways to build a campaign. How do you usually build a campaign?
I like to sort of take elements from all of the different methods and throw them together. For my home campaign, I started off running Keep on the Shadowfell and modified that as I went. I've thrown in elements of collaborative story building, where I've had players come up with NPCs that they're going to interact with later, and I try and guide the story in a way that's going to interest the players. So I use their backgrounds to really drive the story. And lately I've been experimenting a little bit with some sandbox style play, just to see where the players go and what kind of stuff they do.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, and my current campaign anyway, I designed sort of the story ideas as I was reading the fourth edition Forgotten Realms campaign guide.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept seeing certain themes or ideas in there that in my head, I don't know if it was intended this way, but in my head they were all connected into one larger story. Mm-hmm. So I read a published book and saw an obvious story there and decided to start telling that story, and took an approach of, okay, the campaign starts and here's your situation. How are you interacting with that situation? How do you end up being there? Wherever you're from, how do you end up being part of this larger story? And so I gave a little bit more guidance prior to character creation, I guess.
Right.
And I think that's a legitimate way to go is say, okay, here's the world, here's the setting, here's the kind of story I want to tell. And so use those limitations to come up with a creative character that you're going to have fun with.
Right. And I think we're probably going to talk a little bit about that later on in the player section. But I think it is important to sort of sit down with the players and everyone sort of create characters together while you're sort of fleshing out what the game is going to be, so that everything is tied together. You definitely want your PCs to be tied to the setting in some way, and preferably tied to each other. So it's not just, you meet in a tavern and a mysterious stranger tells you to go off and find the magic MacGuffin.
Right. Good. One of the other sort of assumptions we're going to keep here is that we're going to give some basic outlines and some ideas here, but it's worth noting that the stories change. You know, when I started my campaign, it was going to be a zombie apocalypse game, and then things changed, things morphed, and it turned into a let's go talk to the gods and try to bring one back from the dead game.
Yeah, no. It's the same kind of thing in my campaign. I started off, like I said, with Keep on the Shadowfell, and I had this idea that Orcus was going to be the big main campaign villain, and that's really not the case anymore. It's now, you know, we're focusing on this retrieving an artifact, and during that time, the players are going to find out about an invasion that's happening from another country, and that'll segue into a planar invasion, and all of this may change by the time they get to level 15.
Right.
I think it's important to stay supple when you're creating a campaign, because the PCs will throw you curveballs, and you want to try and run with those as much as possible.
Right. So, I mean, and that's why I think it's useful to sort of outline your basic story threads, because you don't want to spend a lot of time detailing exactly what's going to happen, when it's going to happen, where it's going to happen, because these things will change, and then you've wasted all that time.
Yeah.
You sort of outline it, and then you can pick and choose some things and say, oh, well, the story's changed, but there are some elements in my original outline that I can still include, and then you just rework the outline from wherever you're at forward.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't want to reinvent the wheel every time the players, you know, change their focus, but you do want to be able to sort of create the elements of your story to be flexible enough so that you can reskin them if you need to.
But on the other hand, I also like the idea of having an idea where my story's going, you know,
because
that helps inform a lot of things. When they run into an NPC, I know who that NPC is because I know where my story's going and I know what kind of role I need that character to play later on in the story.
Right. And that, yeah, like you said, that allows you to build in recurring characters, recurring villains. It allows you to do a little bit of foreshadowing, and all of those things can be really effective story tools.
Right. Good. And then we're also going to focus on opening a campaign. So we're primarily looking at lower level, how did the thing started. There could be some threads and some themes that we build that goes on through all the way up to, you know, the end of the campaign or to epic tier and 30th level or whatever. But we're going to focus on starting small.
Okay. I think that's definitely a good way to go.
Right. I mean, and campaigns can start at other levels and at other tiers, but we're going to start low, just because that's sort of a good, you know, starting at the beginning is seems to be make sense.
Right.
And then now we start getting into some setting things, right? We're not necessarily going to say, you know, we're playing in this world or that world or whatever, but I think you need to at least give some starting ideas, you know? You know, so for example, in this case, I'm going to say that our starting location is going to be a small city, maybe a few hundred people, that is largely supporting an agrarian farming community in the area, and that we've got a certain number of PCs. You know, that way we know what we're working with. The PCs will include, let's say, a human rogue from a local farm village, a dwarf fighter who is from the desert and, you know, fights all kinds of stereotypes because that's not a typical place for a dwarf to be from, a halfling wizard who was born under a prophecy to be the savior of magic, whatever that means, an elf cleric of following a god of secrets, and a dragonborn paladin who's been exiled from his home. These would all be concepts and ideas that your players would bring to the table, and so I just sort of put some random things together, and again, sort of in the theme of Essentials just came out, most of those combinations could be made using the new Essentials books.
Right.
So that's our party.
Sounds like a good party to me.
All right. So the first thing we got to figure out when we're putting together our story is how do we get them together?
Okay. Something I really like to do is involve the PCs in this and really ask them to tell me how they know each other. Try and tie each PC to at least one other PC so that you don't just have this disparate group of weirdos who are adventuring together for no particular reason.
Okay, so you ask the players, you know, let's try to start the campaign with you guys already knowing each other.
Yeah, I mean, that's one way to go. You can also have them meet partway through, you know, during some sort of conflict that forces them together. And either one can really work. I prefer the former because if the PCs are telling you why they're adventuring together, then they're more likely to remember that and they're more likely to be invested in that reason.
Right. Yeah, and sometimes players will be open to that and work with that and come up with something very good. Sometimes I find that DMs need to give a little bit more structure. You know?
I think that can be the case as well. I definitely have players in my game who want a little bit more structure and don't want to be given that much narrative control. And in that case, sometimes maybe you need to use a combination of the two.
Yeah. I don't think it's illegitimate to say, you know, you're all in this city, whatever we're going to call it, and you all have, for whatever reason, temporarily joined the local militia.
Right.
Right. Now you tell me why, and you're all sort of in the same unit working together.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I actually did a similar thing in my campaign where I had everyone join. Everyone was part of a sort of professional adventurers guild called the Wardens, who served the crown, and that was their reason for adventuring together was that they were assigned to the same patrol. So.
Right. And so I think that kind of thing can be a decent combination of the two, right? The DM is doing that, and as a DM, so let's say that's our hook. We're going to say that everybody is a member of the same patrol in a local militia.
Okay.
That makes it real easy for them to take some buy-in. Okay, now why am I part of this militia? Let's tell that story. And maybe some of us did know each other ahead of time. And we all decided to join the militia together, you know,
mm-hmm.
Or maybe we just met at this militia, you know, in training or whatever. And we sort of hit it off. And as a group, we worked well together. So they kept us together or however they want to sort of tell that story. But we've given them the outline of you're in this militia.
Right.
You know,
That approach is actually really nice because it gives the PC some structure, and it also gives you as the DM a lot of ways to introduce quest hooks,
right. Because
you can just give them assignments from their superiors to get them to go off in a specific direction and then see what they're interested once they do that.
Yeah, and if nothing else, it gives me as a DM the chance to know where the story's going to be when we show up at that first session. You know,
right.
Unless your first session is just going to be sitting around and talking about the campaign and building your characters, as a DM, you want to have some prep to know what kind of encounters you're going to have. So now, suddenly, I know at least that they're all going to be part of this same patrol in the local militia.
Yeah, and it's very useful to know at least something about the group before you start playing. 4E is not really the kind of game that you can do off the cuff that easily.
Right. So... And I think that sort of starts begging the question of our larger storyline then, of if they're all part of this local militia that's being formed, even if it's only temporarily being formed, why does this small community suddenly need new members of a militia? Is there something going on? Are there events happening in the area that require the use of a militia?
Yeah. Something I was thinking of based on what you had sent me before was... Maybe if the halfling wizard was born under a prophecy to save magic, that implies that something is going wrong with magic right now. Maybe the threads of magic are unraveling, and that's causing all sorts of strange things to happen and creating all sorts of aberrant creatures that are threatening local communities. And maybe that's why the militia was formed in response to something of that nature.
Okay, so maybe there's a group or an organization that's working near or in town that's actually causing some of these problems with magic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or maybe the problems with magic haven't even happened yet, but they are going to cause it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the party can start to interact with this group already.
Right.
Is this going to be a religious group? Is it going to be a group of, you know, cultists and demon worshippers? Is it going to be a group of wizards that are just doing experiments going awry?
Well, I'm partial to cultists myself, but then I really like the Far Realm. So that's probably the route that I'd be inclined to go in. The nice thing about cultists is that they tend to work with anyone who gets the job done. So you could introduce all sorts of wizards and evil priesthoods and stuff as well that are just sort of pawns of these insane cultists who are trying to, you know, bring down the world or something.
Okay. So maybe we've got a group of nihilistic Far Realm based cultists that are trying to use the threads of magic to bring about the end of the world.
Right.
And this brings us another opportunity, I think, to bring in one of our PC's backgrounds, because we did mention an elf cleric who follows the God of Secrets. Mm-hmm. It occurs to me that what if we have one of the main sects of this cult be former followers of the same god, and they learned some very disturbing secrets, and that's about the Far Realm, and that's when they sort of went a little crazy and became part, you know, started this cult.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
So now we've got the elf cleric involved as well.
Yeah. I think having the wizard and the cleric involved right away like that is great. I think the human rogue is almost has a built-in investment just being from the area that's being threatened.
Mm-hmm.
Paladin to some extent has a little bit of built-in investment as well, just because he's a paladin. But the big question mark that I want to know about the paladin is, why was he exiled from his home?
Mm-hmm.
If he's a paladin and he was exiled from his home, was he exiled because he broke his vows, or was he exiled because being a paladin is at odds with his homeland? And if that's the case, if it is at odds with his homeland, maybe the people from his homeland are behind this cult.
Yeah, I was just thinking the same thing. Is that what if somebody back home was involved in the formation of this cult and or is supporting it or backing it, and you know, maybe they're the leader of this cult. Somebody that was important back home. Maybe he was accused of murdering somebody, but it turns out that person was faking their death in order to go off and form this cult.
Yeah,
and now he's been exiled, but in his exile, he's hunting for this person to prove his innocence.
Right. Yeah.
And so now we're also starting to build a villain in the story as well.
Right. Now the dwarf fighter was the one that I had the most trouble with coming up with a hook. Actually the fact that he's from the desert puts me a little bit in mind of the recently released Dark Sun setting. So maybe we can use an element of that, in that maybe this cult has been somewhat successful in other parts of the world. And that's where some of the deserts of the world have come from. And maybe he's from one of those deserts, and his goal is to try and stop that from happening to the rest of the world.
So maybe it was even historically, thousands of years ago or whatever, a similar cult formed and was nearly successful. And in their near success, they created the desert homeland that the dwarf is from. You know, and then that was some of the secrets that the clerics... compatriots sort of delved into is this ancient, now desert civilization, and they found out what happened.
Yeah.
And so now this dwarf has a buy-in to the whole thing as well, because, well, this has already happened to my land, and we don't want to see it happen to the rest of the world as well.
Right.
Maybe the dwarf was there or was around when these clerics found whatever ancient lore from the far realm was found, you know, but you know, they got away to start the cult anew, and now he's hunting them down.
So now we've got everyone invested in the story. So what's next?
I want to talk a little bit more about our villain.
Okay.
One of the things I think makes an adventure and a story really engaging is having a villain and knowing who the villain is and what they're all about. So I think we want to detail that villain a little bit more. We've sort of established that this was a villain. This was a person who was a member of a faith that involved the God of Secrets. and that they uncovered a secret in the desert that led them to the Far Realm, drove them insane, and now they are nihilistic and trying to destroy the world through the use of magic.
Right.
But who is this villain?
Well, let's see. If he's from the Paladin's homeland, that means that he's probably a Dragonborn. Maybe he's even someone that the Paladin personally knew and trusted for a while and was betrayed by.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even a family member or something.
Okay, so we can have the brother or the uncle or whatever.
Yeah, I mean it's a pretty classic trope of fantasy literature.
Right, but I think you'd want to sort of talk to the Dragonborn's player a little bit to work out, you know. And in a lot of these cases, you'd want to talk to those players to work it all out. But, you know,
right.
I'd hate to be creating family members for a PC without discussing that with them first.
Yeah, absolutely.
But some sort of person that was related to the Dragonborn, either by blood or a mentor or something like that.
Mm-hmm. The way I tend to approach my villains is it's sort of the same way I approach my campaigns. If it's a campaign-wide villain, I have a general idea of what the villain's goals are, and I might have like a name and an image in my head, but a lot of the villain's motivations and specific goals are going to be built through the course of play, and in many cases, probably in reaction to what the players do.
Mm-hmm.
So that I can really sort of tie that villain even more to the players and get them more invested in defeating him and make it that much more satisfying when they do.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess then what are the – I mean, we know that this villain is a nihilist. You know, he's trying to end the world, so to speak.
Right.
By bringing something out of the Far Realm. He's got some connections to magic, but how is he doing that? What is his actual specific goal?
Well, I had a thought that maybe there was this Tome of Secrets, of arcane secrets, that has that is rumored to have the key to harnessing the power of the Far Realm, and maybe he's after that. The players find that out, and they decide, well, we got to stop this guy from getting his hands on this thing, because that would be bad.
Okay. And maybe this town is specifically important. Maybe there are some ruins under the town or near the town.
Right.
That hide this Book of Secrets. Part of me even wants to think of it like the Book of Secrets is hidden in a sort of little pocket dimension.
Mm-hmm.
That can only be accessed in certain areas, and this town happens to sit on top of like ley lines or lines of magical power.
Yeah.
So this is one of the few locations in the world where he can get to the pocket dimension where the book is hidden.
Right, and that would also mean by extension that like even if the campaign winds up ranging all over the world, eventually they're probably going to come back to this location, because like the implication is that the boundaries between the world and the Far Realm are particularly weak at this town. So it wouldn't make sense that when the villain has to perform whatever ritual he has to perform to bring things over from the Far Realm, it has to be done at that town. So it sort of brings everything back to where it started.
Right. And it also helps sort of, I guess we had originally mentioned, you know, there might be ancient ruins or something nearby, but this sort of that's sort of a standard and worn trope. This sort of allows us to make this location important without having to have those typical ruins, you know,
right?
Ancient ruins under the town or nearby or whatever. We can have just a normal, everyday small town here, but it's important because of these unseen magical ley lines.
Right, and until recently, people didn't even know that it was important. It's just, you know, this villain and his henchmen that know at the moment, and, you know, the PCs will eventually learn why it's important and why they have to stop the villain from using it.
Okay, so we have our Dragonborn wizard, sorcerer, or whatever, trying to conduct some sort of ritual in the town that's almost certainly, I assume, going to destroy the town in the process.
I would imagine so.
Leaving it some sort of wasteland or desert or whatever, like we've seen in the other location with the dwarf.
Right.
So how, I guess, the story building then up to that eventual final sort of conclusion and conflict comes down to, I think a lot of it comes down to, how is this villain doing that ritual? What are the parts that he needs to do in order to eventually build to this ritual? Is he,
right.
Is he sacrificing people? Is he summoning monsters? Is he stealing things all over town? How does this build up?
I think that it could probably start with just a simple monster incursion that the villain is using as sort of a smokescreen for more nefarious activities. And you know, partway through the first adventure, the PCs maybe stumble upon the villain by chance, and the Dragonborn recognizes him, and that's sort of what leads them to go after him in the first place.
Okay, and that would make sense given that the town is forming new militias and hiring, you know, random strangers that just wandered in to help protect them.
Right.
So he's hiring some sort of monsters, probably. I mean, we're talking first level, so probably, you know, kobolds or goblins or whatever.
Right. And to sort of go along with the Far Realm influence, you could even just sort of reskin kobolds and goblins to give them minor deformities and some slightly weird powers. You could use one of the monster themes from the Dungeon Master's Guide 2 that introduces more Far Realm abilities to existing creatures.
Okay, very cool. So you've got this incursion of monsters, and it's a smokescreen, and that's their first sort of interaction with this villain, is that he's bringing these monsters into town to cover up the fact that he's doing something else.
Right.
So what is this something else that he's doing?
Maybe right now he's just trying to figure out if this is where the book actually is. He might not know yet, or he might know its location but not know how to get to it.
Okay.
Maybe he's looking for a person that can help him.
So he's doing something in town to figure out where the exact location is and make sure this is the spot, and doing some tests. And he's keeping the town busy with these attacks.
Right.
So they're not bothering to notice that he's wandering around town and casting various rituals to detect things and find the right spot.
Right, exactly. I had a thought that maybe there was some, you know, NPC that was hidden somewhere within the town, and the attacks were a way to sort of draw him out so that the villain could get to him and interrogate him to try and find out more information about the book.
And maybe it was some former great hero, who's, you know, who's rumored to still be alive and hiding in this town, who was involved in, you know, delving into the ruins back in the desert and knows something about what's going on.
Right. Maybe it was even the halfling wizard's master when he was just an apprentice.
Uh-huh. And so these attacks might be an attempt to, you know, everything's, if he doesn't do something, the town's going to be destroyed. So this guy, this hidden hero, is going to have to do something and reveal himself. I like that.
Right. And what's nice about that is that it adds more hooks for the PCs in the future, because if his knowledge is so dangerous, he's going to want to stay hidden, but he's going to need someone to do his work for him. So he makes a very good patron for the PCs.
Uh-huh. And maybe our villain does something to him when he does reveal himself that severely diminishes his power.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
Hits him with a curse or, you know, whatever. So that this villain or this hero isn't able to just save the day. And that's why, you know, and then he uses that to capture the hero and get the information he needs out of him in order to bring the book out.
Right. So he has the knowledge that he needs to save the world, but not the power.
But not the power anymore. I think that works really well.
Yeah.
And then so the party becomes important. So I could see an opening sort of storyline where the town is attacked. You know, that's the first encounter or two, is the town's being attacked. The party is fighting back. Eventually, the party thinks they're clever. They've figured out where the kobold attacks are coming from. They travel out into the nearby wilderness and find the kobold's lair or goblins or whatever we're using, and sort of defeats them. There's some sort of... minor climax to the story at that point. They defeat some sort of boss that you know, was the chieftain of the group.
Right.
But meanwhile, what they don't realize is that the real story is happening back in town.
Right. And maybe they find that out from the kobold boss, who, you know, not being a kobold and not being all that brave, you know, squeals and tells them exactly what they need to know. But if they don't hurry back to town, they're going to be too late. And maybe they are too late, and the next adventure is trying to save this guy from the evil wizard.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe our wizard hero actually makes a cameo during those first couple of encounters in town defending it.
Right.
And then when the party goes off to defeat the kobold leaders in their own lair, that's when he's captured.
Yeah.
So they come back, and he's already been kidnapped, and now they've got to go through this sort of it's a small town, but it's a bit of an urban adventure, and do some investigation and figure out where this guy went, what happened to him, what have you.
And there may be some minions of the wizard planted throughout the town to give false leads and in general just try and slow the PCs down.
Right. And maybe this wizard inadvertently is making it difficult to find him anyway. He's been hiding in this town all along. He's probably covered in some sort of enchantments to make it difficult to find him. So that
probably.
So not anybody could just cast a divination and see where he's at.
Right.
So the next sort of string of the adventure then is finding this hero.
Right.
Releasing the hero.
And then basically finding out from the hero what actually is going on.
Right. And then they get to the real story of, well, I've been here for the last several decades protecting these lines of power because I knew this is where the Book of Secrets was hidden. And I knew that someday somebody could come looking for it. And we get a little bit of exposition there. So now they've got the actual story. Now they've got to find and stop the villain himself.
Right. And I can see the next couple of adventures being tracking down leads, finding the villain's lieutenants, and you know, fighting them, interrogating them to try and get more information about where this villain is and what he's after.
Right.
And sort of like follow those leads until they actually find the villain, maybe towards the end of the heroic tier.
And I could even see setting up a situation to make it even easier, where maybe the villain has to establish certain points or lines in the town to create sort of a larger diagram or a summoning circle or whatever you want to call it. And so as the party learns more and more about how this ritual works, they can try to thwart some of those attempts. You know, maybe there has to be ritual sacrifices done in certain locations around town. And so they're running around town trying to stop these so that it's not just really easy for the guy to do what he needs to do.
Right.
Ultimately, in the end, though, he needs to be our villain. We want him to be successful in being able to cast the ritual.
Right.
So that the big climax at the end will be charging in and stopping him at the last moment.
Right. And maybe the sort of twist at the end is that this ritual is the first part of a larger ritual. And that's how we segue into further adventures in the Paragon tier and the Epic tier. So maybe the villain even sacrifices himself to complete the ritual. So the PCs get sort of a partial victory there, where they defeat the guy, but his ritual comes to fruition and his masters are able to continue his work.
Yeah, that sounds good. And I think, the end of this story arc that we've outlined, depending on how you pace it out and what kind of side quests and things happen along the way, you could end up doing this and defeating this villain could be your end of heroic tier,
right?
Sort of climax. And then you lead into the story of, but they're not alone and there's other things going on and there's other lines of power around the world maybe. And so you've got all these other things going on. And eventually, the story could go to the point where this is all being done by the machinations of some great old one in the Far Realm, and in Epic Tier, you go to the Far Realm and kill it.
Yeah, absolutely. Alibar makes a really good villain for the entire campaign. in this particular instance, from the Monster Manual 3.
Yeah. Very cool. All right. Well, I think we've built a decent outline for at least the heroic tier of a campaign that could lead to bigger and larger things.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts you have on our outline before we move along to the next section here?
Just one other thought. If the PCs, or if you wanted to introduce a further twist, you could actually reveal to the PCs that the villain is not trying to obtain the book, but trying to destroy the book. And maybe the PCs are trying to find ways to protect the book from being destroyed. Maybe the book acts as sort of a linchpin that holds the ley lines together.
And so if he destroys the book, then magic goes wild and it potentially tears a rift in the world, letting the Far Realm leak in.
Exactly. And then your wizard knows what his prophecy is actually about.
Right on. And yeah, and I even considered at one point that we have a cleric of a god of secrets. It wouldn't be unreasonable to talk to that player and maybe see if there's a possible deception that could be happening there. I mean, if you're a follower of a god of secrets, you probably have some secrets yourself.
And, right.
You know, there's some potential storylines there that may or may not be possible depending on what that player wants to do.
Right. He might want the book for his own clergy and for his own reasons.
Right. Very good. All right, well, I'm going to throw things over to my good friend Tracy Hurley from Sarah Dark Magic for a quick segment before we head into our advice for players on what you can do to make the start of a new campaign successful.
This is Tracy from SarahDarkMagic.com with some more player tips. One reason I love tabletop role-playing games, such as D&D, is that the only thing that limits what our characters can do is our imagination, and, well, what we can negotiate with our DM. Given the relatively light rule set of many earlier D&D editions, I think this is something those players knew, but many of us may have forgotten. Fortunately, the 4th edition Dungeon Master's Guide has a great section called Actions Rules Don't Cover, conveniently found on page 42. What's great about this section is that it gives the DM all the information they need to come up with the difficulty class and improvised damage on the fly. If you want to swing from the chandelier and kick the ogre into a fire, you can do it. Or at least you can if the dice are on your side. So why is this important to players? It means that you aren't limited to what your character sheet and powers tell you you can do. You can make stuff up. Sure, you might want to let your DM know first so they have the page open. And for particularly cool actions, your DM might ask you to give up one of your encounters or dailies, or other resources you have available. But no one should feel limited by their character sheets unless they or their DM want them to be. Likewise, if you haven't seen the new Rules Compendium or Heroes of the Fallen Lands, you might want to check them out. The skills section in those books includes great advice on how to use your skills to improvise other actions, such as binding a creature with rope using thievery, or crafting a hidden compartment using stealth. These are just two ways any table can customize a game to fit their style. I hope you consider using them at your table.
We are back, and now we're going to talk a little bit about what players can do to make the beginning of a new campaign successful. You're starting a new campaign. You're building your characters. What can you do to make sure that you're doing your part to make this campaign awesome?
Right. One of the biggest things that PCs can do, or the players can do to make sure their PCs are well integrated into the game, is just to look at the characters that the other players are building and try and build connections between them, and to look at the setting that is being presented and try and build connections to the setting, because the more connections you have to the other PCs and to the setting, the more hooks the DM has to put in front of you and say, hey, look, here's something you're interested in, go do it.
Yeah, and that's pretty similar to my first bit of on my notes, the first bit of advice I had as well, as I worded it as add to the story.
Right,
make your character part of what's going on and add to it. It doesn't matter what campaign setting you're talking about. If you've got the most thoroughly detailed campaign setting in the world, you know, you're playing Forgotten Realms with a bunch of people that know the Forgotten Realms inside and out, there's still a lot to that world that is not detailed, and your character can add to that story.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that comes down to knowing what kind of story you're telling, too, you know?
Right. And it's okay to discover that as you go along, but as you're discovering it, don't be afraid to go to your DM and say, you know, I have this idea for an NPC that my character has ties to. Is it okay if he gets introduced to the world? I have this idea for an organization that I'd like to be a part of. Is it okay if that gets introduced?
Right. And a lot of times, a good DM, I think, will be thrilled at the idea of you doing so.
Absolutely.
I know as a DM, if somebody comes to me and says, hey, I've got this NPC I'd like to introduce into the world, you know, it's an old rival of mine. Well, hey, great. I've got a villain built in now.
Exactly. The DM is going to be thrilled at having a little bit less work to do and having something that he can use that he knows that you're interested in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, yeah, and there's a lot of ways you can do that, whether it's an NPC or an organization. It gives the DM more story instead of limiting the kinds of stories that can be told.
Right.
I think it's also probably important to make team dynamics a little bit easier, especially at the start of a campaign. You know, you don't want to make the lone wolf character that just has no reason at all to be with the party.
Yeah, you definitely want to make sure that you're that your character can play well with others. If you're the only evil character in an all good party, that might be okay, but you need to work with the rest of the party and make sure that you don't disrupt everyone else's fun because it's what your character would do.
Right. And it's okay to make the one evil PC in a good party. It's okay to make the lone wolf character that likes to go off and do things alone. But there are a lot of strategies that one can use to play those characters and as part of a team.
Right. And I think just to talk about the lone wolf character for a second, I think that particular concept can work really well for a player who knows that he's not going to be at the game that often. If he knows that he's going to miss a lot of sessions, then being the lone wolf could provide a built-in story-based way for him to not be there during one session, uh-huh, and then show up in the next session.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I actually just wrote an article that I'm going to be publishing shortly about a character that I built that was a lone wolf. But at the same time, his story was built to be very parallel to the story that I knew the DM was telling.
Right.
So this lone wolf character had every bit of motivation to stay with the party because they had the exact same motives.
Right.
And the one instant where they didn't have a reason to be together, I just sort of shrugged and said, okay, well, he's going to go off and I'm no hard feelings. I'm going to bring in a new character just for a little bit. And it gave me a chance to play with another PC as well.
Yeah. So definitely. Yeah. I think it's important, to sort of keep in mind the distinction between your character and yourself, so that if you create a character that might have some tension with the rest of the party, you make sure that that tension doesn't become real tension between you and the other players. You make sure that that tension adds to the fun of the game rather than detracting from it.
Right. And I think that, I mean, it's the same thing with authors who are writing characters as well sometimes, is that you also need to make have some understanding that you're the author of this character's actions and who they are. So when people tell me, well, this is how my character has to act because that's what they would do, well, that's only what they would do because you say it is.
Right.
You know, so you can choose that that's not what they would do if it means that we're all going to have a better time.
Right. Characters are not automatons. They're not slaves to their programming or anything like that. They do what you want them to do. And yeah, I think oftentimes that's what my character would do, is used as an excuse to be kind of a jerk.
Right. I would tend to agree. Let's see. What else do I have on my list we haven't talked about? My next sort of point that I wanted to mention was to go with the flow a little bit. Opening stories can be tough. Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes a little bit awkward, and you have to suspend disbelief a little bit more to get that party together for the first time and to get them hooked into a story. And that can be hard to do. And so if it doesn't really go very smoothly, my suggestion is, as a PC, you know what? Just go with it. Don't give the DM a hard time. You know, if it means that you got to stay on rails a little bit for the first, you know, opening part of the story, then do that, because it allows the story to get started, and through play you become more invested in what's happening. You know, so you don't have that background of, well, we've been playing this for five levels, when you're starting off a new campaign at level one. And so my suggestion is be prepared to go with the flow a little bit and not give the DM and the other players a hard time with that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a school of thought that says that it's the DM's job to make sure the players are having fun. And that's true, but it's also the player's job to make sure that the DM is having fun. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning of a session, the DM has a lot of pressure to make the session good and to make a good first impression for the campaign. And the players can help a lot just by buying into what he's putting in front of them. Right. Even if that quest hook doesn't completely interest you, buying into it a little bit and going along with it can lead to some really fun situations. And eventually there's going to be some other quest hook that you're going to be more interested in anyway. So,
right. And then I only have one other thing on my list of things I wanted to talk about. And then I guess we'll see if you have any more on your list of notes. But I also thought, in terms of making life easier for the DM in that same sort of vein, if you have concerns or questions about how things went, it's probably not helpful to bring that up, you know, as it's happening.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a time and a place to bring up concerns. And I think the time and the place is after the session in private, so that you're not, you know, embarrassing the DM or just sort of making his life harder.
Right. Because if nothing else, you know, maybe you come to the game and you think it's going to be one kind of a game, well, you know, with one kind of a story, and it turns out the DM's not telling that kind of story. And you have concerns about that because you're not interested in the kind of story the DM's playing. It's not helpful to have that conversation in the middle of that session. The DM can't, you know, the DM's done all this prep. You know, and it's really hard for him to just say, oh, well, you don't want this kind of story? Let me completely turn this thing around right now and play a different session tonight. That's hard to do. So just go with it, play through that session, and then when you get a chance afterwards, talk to the DM and say, hey, I didn't know that this is what the story was going to be like. I was hoping to play something like this. Do you think we can sort of mix these two together?
Right. And the other thing to bear in mind is that even if you're not thrilled with the way the story is going in the very beginning, the other players at the table might be. And, you know, the result of you bringing it up right then and there might just be getting shouted down by the rest of the players. And that's probably going to create a situation where there's a lot of real tension that makes the game less fun for everyone. And I think if you do bring things like that up at the end of the session in a slightly less emotionally charged setting, your DM's going to be a lot more receptive to your feedback, and a good DM will work with you to try and make the game something that you can enjoy.
Right. And I think sometimes that's appropriate to bring it up in private, and sometimes it's okay to bring that up with the group once the session is over.
Right.
Because, again, maybe the other players are really enjoying that kind of story, and maybe this just isn't the group for you or the game for you.
Right. Exactly.
So what else do you have in terms of advice for players to make the beginning of a campaign awesome?
Well, one thing that I always appreciate as a DM is when players are really creative with their actions and their descriptions. I know in 4th edition it can be really easy to get into the mindset of these power cards in front of me are what I can do. But I know that, you know, if a player says, oh, I'm going to slide down the banister and jump and drop kick the orc in the face, I almost always say, that's awesome. Yes, do it. Here's your check.
Right.
And I think things like that really add to the energy of the table and can really make things a lot more fun for everyone at the table. And I that's something I really appreciate from a player.
Yeah. I mean, I had a similar situation in my game just last night where I was I just really wasn't sure how to adjudicate it all, because the player wanted to use a power that allowed him to get a bonus for jumping. Mm-hmm. But he wanted to use it to jump over the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at the rules and the mechanics for it all, I was thinking, well, that's a pretty high vertical jump that you're probably not going to be successful at. But we could probably describe that as, you know, you sort of do an acrobatic roll over the back of the enemy and that kind of stuff. Cause, and I'm like, you know, that would be great to do, and I fully support it because it's cool. So let's find a way to make it happen. On the other hand, I also had to say, well, but you're also going to provoke an opportunity attack. Just be aware, because you know, any kind of movement like that is gonna provoke. At which point they opted not to do it anyway, and I was a little bit disappointed because there was an element of you're doing something different and cool and creative, and I kind of wanted to encourage that at the same time.
Yeah, I think as the DM, you want to try and encourage that stuff as much as possible without making it too abusable.
Right.
And that's kind of a fine line to walk. But as the player, just, you know, ask the DM if it's something that you can do.
Right.
If you have a really cool idea in mind, ask if it's something that you can do. And if the DM thinks it's really cool too, hopefully he'll let you do it. And you know, even if it's not necessarily as effective as you wanted it to be, it will still probably be a lot of fun.
Sure. Yeah. And I know as a DM, I'm always putting little terrain features and things into a map in mm-hmm. in hopes that the players will do something unexpected with it, you know?
Yeah.
I do all that stuff for a reason. It's not just to make the map look pretty.
Right.
And sometimes it plays out, and sometimes that terrain feature never comes into play at all. But I always try to do that just to encourage them to think on it.
Yeah, and I mean, definitely don't be afraid to ask questions about the battle map. It's like the DM may have put something on the map just because it looked cool, and you might see it and latch onto it and say, hey, can I do this with it? And that might be something that the DM never thought of but thinks is really, really cool. And I mean, that's just gonna lead to more situations like that happening in the future.
Absolutely. Any other suggestions you had?
None that I can think of at the moment.
All right. Then let's sort of summarize what we discussed today. We talked about building an opening story, an opening campaign. We said that there were lots of ways to do it, but the way we did it was heavily used the characters and the backgrounds of those characters, but we also wanted to sort of establish how the thing was going to start.
Right.
But we used those backgrounds and sort of tied things together and weaved some things together from the characters to build a story, which I think is really powerful, because I know a lot of DMs will require that their players come with a paragraph or a page or whatever of background for their characters. We developed what I think is a pretty darn cool storyline, and we literally had one line about each character to build off of. So I think that builds that shows, you know, how you can build something that's interesting and creative, collaborating a little bit with your players along the way to do it.
Right. And I mean, if you just think about this was a campaign arc built by two DMs just spitballing. Imagine how much cooler it would be if it was you with five players all collaborating and coming up with how this thing's going to start in the first place. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be, you know, amplified that much more in terms of coolness.
Yeah. And we also talked about the importance of having a good villain. Mm-hmm. And that the villain's motivations will drive a lot of the rest of the action, including, you know, the story build and the end. And that depending on how that story comes together, look for ways to turn that opening story arc into later story arcs as well as they get bigger and bigger.
Right. Your villain is going to set the tone of your campaign. And make sure that the villain is a villain that you want to stick with for a while. And if you find out later that it's not, don't be afraid to kill him off and come up with a new villain that sets the tone that you want.
Yeah. And then we talked about some, as a player, what you can do to make the beginning of a campaign successful. And we basically said, put lots of things in there to help build the story, lots of things the DM can play off of. We also talked about not being difficult, whether it be being difficult in terms of joining the group or being difficult in terms of going along with that opening story. It basically comes down to, you know, don't make things hard for people. Just go with it for now, and if there's problems later, deal with those later after the session.
Right. Exactly.
Does that sort of summarize what we talked about pretty well today?
I think so.
All right. Then I'm going to call that episode 150. I want to thank our sponsor for the episode, Noble Knight Games, as well as our segment providers, Tracy Hurley from SarahDarkMagic.com and Mike Shea from Sly Flourish, as well as our guest of the episode, Brian Engard.
Thanks very much for having me. I had a lot of fun.
Good. And people can find you once again at GameCrafters.net. Did I get that right?
Yeah, you did.
Awesome. And people can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com, visit the forums, which are linked on the website, and call up the Tomes Biz line at 919-BIZ-TOME with your thoughts, questions, or comments for any upcoming episodes. Don't forget to review the show on iTunes or get out there and tell people about it to help the show grow. And don't forget to consider checking out the Tomes Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. We get part of the proceeds, and that helps pay the bills. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. This has been episode 150, where a bond has been formed that can never be broken amongst a new band of adventurers who will surely save or perhaps doom the world forever. And it all depends on the mood of Brian Engard in this episode of...
I'm on the wall.